This is an interview with Gemma Bentley and Gilly King of Whitelands College about the May Queen and recorded by Faye Morey.
Okay, so this is Faye Morey and this is the Making Mischief Oral History Project, and it's the 19th of June 2023, and I'm here with
Gilly King,
Gemma Bentley.
Okay, so we're going to be discussing the May Day and the May Queen, and we're at the Whitelands College. So first of all, one by one, I wondered if you could talk me through your personal backgrounds, including how you ended up at the Whitelands College Archive and involved with the May Day.
I started here in 1999, and I came on a 4-month contract to put a historic database in regarding the May monarchs, and I'm still here, but I'm not actually at Whitelands. So having done the 4-month sort of database, then there was a big event that the university ran, and the current head of college, the then head of college, asked me to stay on to organise that event. And then he asked me to organise May Day because he was leaving. So he wanted to pass on all his knowledge, a man called Reverend Dr. David Peacock, very eminent principal here. And he also has written his doctorate on May Day. I don't know if you've read it, but it's phenomenal. So he then, in effect, passed the mantle over, because one of the findings of his doctorate is that there's always been one person who, whatever, will make May Day last. So at the very beginning, it was John Thornthorpe, and then the baton was passed through many, many people. I ended up with it, and then I handed it on to, I can't remember who. Well, you, I suppose.
I guess so.
Yeah, because I carried on, even because I had moved colleges. In 2012, I was permanently at Whitelands, but the university wanted me to go and work on the main campus. But from 2012 and 2013, 2014, I still assisted with May Day, didn't I?
Yeah.
Until I eventually said, threw my toys out the pram and said, I'm not doing this anymore. Only because I'd done it for so long. Yeah, it was enough. And Gemma, assisted by a man called Steve Taggart, have taken up the baton, which is great.
So I've been here since 2014 and I'm a qualified archivist, and I share a 0.9% job with an archivist at the main campus. So I'm here just one day a week. May Day is, I think it's more organised by the college, but I'm here to help look after the May Monarchs and look after the robe collection and the archives.
So going from that, before you came here, had you heard of May Day or know of it?
I was a shipping economist, so no, John Ruskin hadn't really come across my field of knowledge.
So sort of British folk in general hadn't really crossed paths?
Nope. As I said, I worked in the City of London.
Perfect. I think we'll jump straight onto the tradition. So going on to the actual May Day itself and the May Queens and the May Monarchs, what is May Day?
May Day was a pagan ceremony in the Middle Ages, and it celebrated really the rites of spring. There were lots of sexual connotations with it, that you were meant to run into the fields and beget children. It has very traditional roots, but that was its roots. So when John Ruskin made a decision to reintroduce it into this country, he actually first approached a girls' school, and the name of which?
Willington Hall or
Willington
something?
Willington Hall, that's right. And they got quite far down the line of getting May Day introduced into that school. In parallel to that, John Thornthorpe, the principal of Whitelands College, was trying to lure John Ruskin into becoming a college benefactor. And John Ruskin basically said, no, I don't like your college. I think women shouldn't be in a sort of very strict educational establishment. They should be beautiful and let to run free. And I don't like the fact that they get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. So then these were the letters that were going between the two. However, the school suddenly realized that they were going to ask their children to actually celebrate the rites of spring. And they withdrew very promptly. And such was Faunthorpe's desire to get Ruskin on board. The fact that this was an Anglican college, a very strict Anglican college, was brushed under the carpet, and Faunthorpe let Ruskin introduce it at Whiteland's College. And there followed an ongoing battle between Victorian principles and what Ruskin wanted. And I think one of the most fundamental clashes came after year one, when Ruskin was sent photographs of the then May Queen, and he said it looked like something, she looked like something from the Spanish Inquisition, because she was in traditional Victorian dress. There is a theory that she was actually in mourning, but I've never actually seen proof of that. I just think she was in traditional Victorian garb. He wanted something flowing and beautiful and frolicking, all these words that he loved using. So he actually commissioned Kate Greenaway, with whom he was having a, I don't know whether it was an affair or whether it was just a dalliance, to create a dress. And that's the dress you've had at the exhibition. But even then, when Faunthorpe saw it, when Ruskin saw it, he was very unenchanted with it and likened it to looking like Madge Wildfire. And of course, Madge Wildfire is a very strange character from a Walter Scott novel, which I think I sent you illustrations, or there's many illustrations online. And also the girls hated it because they thought they looked like a sack of potatoes in it, because it was just not Victorian fashion at the time. And that's a very strong element, because right the way through, there's always been this conflict between what is desired of a monarch to wear and what the monarch does wear. I can remember in one of my very early May Days, I got a very harsh letter from an old alumni saying that the dress that the May Queen was wearing was far from suitable, and that's Abigail. Right, okay. Which was so, actually, the irony is Abigail's dress, which 2002? Can't remember, just early noughties, was more ethereal than any other monarch's dress, and it was absolutely what Ruskin wanted. So what is for sure is that the collection we have is an extraordinary archive of fashion. And the V&A know about it, so. And that is not probably what Ruskin wanted out of May Day, but that has been one of the biggest outcomes.
So talking about May Day, before we get on to the costume, can you talk me through what day May Day falls on, what happens from start to finish, sort of if there is the processions, or and how maybe from the beginning of the Whitelands history, I read that they used to maybe do performances, you know, how has this evolved on the day, basically the day?
Go for it.
Well, I mean, it's obviously evolved over time. So the first one was in 1881, which I think was just an election of a May Queen. She was robed up. There might be some kind of church, I'm not sure, but an investiture service became quite an important part. So they bringing together with the Anglican part, with the kind of the pagan part. Over time, they had more and more revels, and they became more intricate and outlandish, and strange masks and country dances and things going on. The May pole dancing came in the late 1880s, I think, 1888, something around that time. And that's now quite a big tradition. We've carried that out you know, even now we do it, although no one can actually dance around the maypole anymore, so it's always a bit chaotic.
Can I just put in here?
Yeah.
Of course, with the maypole, that is one of the most phallic symbols of May Day, which is why it wasn't included in the early 1880s.
And ironic as well, I think, because that wasn't actually a part of English May Day tradition.
No.
It came from Europe or something, so... Yeah.
Do you know where in Europe?
Eastern Europe.
I want to say Romania, but I just made that up. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think processions were there right from the start, weren't they?
They liked to process it. The May Queen, up until the 60s, I think, was May Monarch, although they didn't come until later, was voted in by secret ballot. And the important thing is they have to be the likablest and the lovablest, not the cleverest and the prettiest. And these are Ruskin's words, and he was going for charisma, not wisdom. But very early days shows it usually was the prettiest that got voted in, or the nicest. And it was by secret ballot. So until the day, nobody knew who was going to be May Queen. That was one of the very early traditions.
So who would it be? The other college students?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's the juniors, isn't it? Junior year.
Voted for their senior year? Or
voted for someone in junior year.
Yeah. Because it was 2 years. Yeah. College was 2 years.
And the May Day falls on what date?
Very rarely the 1st of May.
I mean, these days, I think it's the 2nd Saturday in May, but I don't know if it used to be the 1st of May at any point, did it?
No, I think even the 1st May Day was not the 1st of May, because it was a Sunday. So there's absolutely no way they could have celebrated it on a Sunday, because it was an Anglican college. And then, because of the strict timetabling and everything, it was formalised as, the 1st Saturday of May. Then, because of exams, it was then sent to the 2nd Saturday of May. Then it was any time that suited the academic year, always in May. In fact, I think, to my knowledge here, there's a couple of times it's been in June. Once when it was in Cambridge, when the evacuated colleges came together at Homerton College, and the other times when Whiteland's College moved from Chelsea to Putney, and they put it in June because Queen Mary, who was going to open the college, couldn't attend in May, so she came in June.
And so were the performances in the earlier May Days, was there any sort of like theme, or was there any like reason for them?
They were called revels.
Revels.
Yeah.
That was the theatrical performance.
That was the theatrical.
They were called revels. Was there any sort of specific themes or reasoning behind them?
No, it's a student performance. Very varying, aren't they?
Yeah.
We've got a fabulous collection of photographs dating way back into sort of late Victorian times, right the way through.
Does the archive hold some of the costumes from those?
I think
one.
Yeah. That's about it, but yeah.
And then, so that was sort of like more the maybe earlier on. What about today, the May Day today? As in, what would the day sort of hold? Like, how was the day?
Well, these days it's the big investiture ceremony, which is held in a big lecture theatre, which is maybe an hour, just over an hour and a half long. Usually a bishop comes to invest the monarch. There's a procession led by Morris dancers. So some confetti. There's a nice big lunch. The May Monarchs have a meeting. And then in the afternoon, it really depends on what the college decide to do that year, how much money they want to spend, whether there's kind of a big fete in the back garden or there's nothing. There's afternoon tea and people go home.
It is traditional that all the former monarchs come back. But when I say all the former monarchs, some have dropped by the wayside. Some, elderly people don't always want to turn up. The younger ones are often pregnant. Well, we've often had them squeezed into their... Yeah.
They get about 30.
And they put their robes back on.
Yeah.
That's the really bizarre thing. And they are suitably altered, usually with gussets, as people grow bigger. And it that's what is really strange, is they come back and then they put their old... And one of the most amusing years for me, my first year ever of running May Day, King Michael came back and I'd put out all the costumes, all the robes were out in the robing rooms. And Michael came to me and said, "Where are my shoes?" I said, "I don't know, Michael." He said, "I've only got sandals." And I said, "Well, you're going to have to possess in sandals because I don't know where your shoes are." We never did find the shoes. He bought a new pair the next year. But it was quite bizarre running around a very large college trying to find shoes for Michael.
You mentioned, so a king. So how, what does the May Day monarch, who sits in the May Day monarch?
Well, when we went co-educational in the 1960s, it took quite a while before the penny to drop that we really shouldn't just vote in the likeablest and the lovablest woman. And so, Gary, King Gary,
85?
86. Oh, 86, yeah. He was the first monarch. And now we have, you know, we have gay monarchs, we have ethnic monarchs, we have, and that's where the term May Queen had to be dropped. And it is very, very, it's an inclusive club, isn't it? Very, all comers welcome.
And all face, which is, again, ironic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because of the Anglican tradition. Or no face, quite secular, really, I think, a lot of the May monarchs these days.
And is there, like, various roles? I read something about the bodyguards?
Attendants.
Or is it so there's the king and the queen and then...
No, just one. A king or
a queen.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Was it always like that or...
Originally it was just a May Queen every year. And then, as we say, 1986, Gary became the first male monarch. And then,
And they could pick, I don't know, 3 or 4 attendants?
Yes,
at the beginning. And now I think they can pick as many as they want, or as few as they want. Like bridesmaids, groomsmen almost, they follow them behind in matching costumes.
And with the costumes, so is there like a committee that sort of runs year round to maybe organise May Day and how the monarch's gonna, is there like a group of people that sort of...
There used to be. Well, it's changed every so often. Once upon a time, for example, Kate Stanley, who was the head of needlework, for many years ran May Day without any interference from anybody else. Then over time, sometimes it's been a committee. When I first took up the reins of running May Day, I dropped the committee straight away because I'm a bit of a... It was too complicated to make so many decisions by committee. And the amount of time that was wasted on writing up minutes to the committee meeting, where the outcome was always the same. Yeah, I just said, no, enough's enough. They then reintroduced it, didn't they? The Guild got very involved when Mark Garner was here. Mm-hmm. So then they did things by committee again. But I don't think they're doing it by committee at the moment. So... it is, as David Peacock writes about in his PhD, you need to have one person pushing it through to make it work, you know, or to keep it to continue, somebody with a passion. I cannot see that it'll last for much longer. But for as long as this time the students enjoy it, then it will continue.
You don't think May Day will last for longer?
I can't see it, but I've been saying that for many years now. What's happened is that after me there have been people who have carried it on saying, yeah, and the students do enjoy it. And the other big sort of hook for it nowadays, it's an alumni day, and so alumni come back, which is a good thing for any, you know, sort of higher education institute or any education institute to have the keen support of alumni, and it is a very good alumni day.
And one last thing in regards to the tradition, you mentioned Morris dancers. So how did Morris dancers get involved in May Day?
I introduced it in 2004. I think they had previously been involved over, you know,
Or a fiddle would lead the procession or something.
A fiddle, yeah, that's something it. It's like a single fiddle, yeah. So I, yeah, that was right up until the 50s, I think, or even 60s. But when we moved here from Putney, the college was based in Putney, and we moved here, and it was quite a bleak place because it had just been completely restored and new buildings everywhere and no grass on the lawn. We had to throw money at it to make it look, you know, and feel fun. So we put a fun fair on the bare lawn, and I introduced Morris dancers, which they were so funny. They were great. They were absolutely brilliant. They got it. They totally got it. They came for years. I think right up to 2014. It was their last time here. But they do sometimes find... You had them this year, didn't you?
Yeah, we had them this year.
Yeah. So... That's a tradition that's not really that traditional.
So what inspired your choice for...
What, Morris dancing? I have a very good friend who sunk a lot of money into a film about Morris dancing. And I asked him why. And he said, because he loves folklore. He plays folk guitar. And he's also extraordinarily wealthy, so he had money to waste. There was a film about Morris dancing, which I went to the premiere of. Wouldn't recommend it. It was quite long. But I thought, hang on a minute, this would really work with May Day. So it was that simple.
Perfect. So now let's talk about the costumes.
Robes.
The robes. Call them robes? Okay. So I think the focus I want to talk about is like its evolution. And the robes worn today, but can you briefly talk about the robes sort of originally worn and how it developed?
Well, as I said earlier, you know, the first one was just her Sunday dress, and in fact for the first three or four it was just that. And then they came up with this idea that Kate Greenaway would produce this one. It was like a sack, so it would fit anybody, which was great because you didn't know who was going to be May Queen. Yeah, if she was going to be a size 10 or a size 16. And then once Ruskin had gone up to Coniston, you know, Kate Greenaway dress was dropped after 6 years? 5 years.
Yeah,
five times it was worn. Yeah. And they went back to their Sunday best. I don't know when the first dress was made by the college.
I think there was a slight gap, wasn't there? 1889, it wasn't the Kate Greenaway dress. It was some dress designed by Formthorpe's wife.
Oh, yes, like she that. Did. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It was never worn again. And then they sort of realised people had to have their own dress. Otherwise, when they came back, they didn't have anything particular to wear. So I reckon about 1900, maybe, or something. Mm,
yeah. Well, Kate Stanley, I suppose, probably introduced her.
Yeah.
Because she was a needlework teacher, but... we haven't got any of the very, very early dresses, i.e. that were their own dresses, because they wouldn't have given those to college. So any that we have would have been made for them by college and kept by college. So, yeah.
The ones that they did make themselves, was it a personal choice of design?
No, they just used their dress, this Sunday best, it's called.
Okay.
Yeah. You didn't have the money to create a dress for one special occasion, which is why I assume the college stepped in.
And what's the symbolism of the flowers that they used to wear?
Well, originally it was daisies and hawthorn, May, because Ruskin wrote this strange book, Be Like Daisies. And he was obsessed with hawthorn, which is called May. Another name for hawthorn, it's called May. So they were the very traditional English sort of flowers. And they used to have, they didn't have a crown, they had a, he didn't want there to be a coronation, but they did have a crown of flowers. And sometimes still do.
Yeah, I have a flower circuit later these days.
And how long, so they, it was their own clothes up until when, sorry?
We don't know. That's really difficult to tell because it's probably somewhere between 1890 and 1910. No, actually by the Edwardian times it was always made for them and they were really glorious robes. It's probably 1901, somewhere around there, when Victoria died. Because as I said, the actual Edwardian robes are, for my mind, astonishing because they are so beautiful. They're also, using that term again, ethereal, very Ruskinian. And it seemed to be that the Edwardian May Queens were beauties, weren't they?
Mm.
We got photographs of them and they were obviously the biggest factor for choosing them was their beauty. So I should perhaps say that before we forget, there is this likeablest and lovablest, and Queen Selma was chosen in 1941.
Yeah.
And she came back for her 70th anniversary, right? So she was in her early 90s when she came back. And she gave this extraordinary speech about that in her day, they were in Durham by this time, evacuated to Durham, that there was a sort of almost revolution within the college that they didn't want to celebrate May Day. So the staff were saying, we've got to keep calm and carry on. That really was the focus. And the students were saying, our boyfriends, our brothers, our fathers are being, you know, slaughtered. We don't want to do this. We don't. And so Selma said that they actually voted in the fattest and the ugliest. Well, she was plump and she wasn't your typical beauty. But I think in terms of charisma, Selma actually did have it all. So I think she did herself an injustice. But that was her belief of why she got voted in as May Queen.
That was during World War II.
41.
And then, so it continued after the wars?
Throughout both wars.
But it was only World War II that they were very much like, we don't want to...
Yes, and there's something about communication as well. When you think the girls that were at college in 1914-18, communication was sparse. The whole of London was keeping calm and carrying on because there were very few bombings. There were a few towards the end of the war, there were such aerial bombings, but there's also Zeppelin bombings. But in theory, it all sort of kept carrying on. And that was very much towing the line, although the slaughter of that war was even worse. But in World War II, there was a lot more knowledge about what was going on. Hence, there could well have been that revolt that Selma talked about. First time I'd heard about it when she, but as she is an original source, I think we have to pay heed to it.
And then, can you talk then after World War II and sort of the May Day, how did it evolve?
It was almost at its strongest, I would have said, post-war. And in fact, some of the main monarchs, well, we know quite a few of the post-war main monarchs. Whitelands College was in Putney. It was a fabulous college, really beautiful. And May Day was huge, absolutely huge. So it didn't suffer at all from the war years. It would have suffered in terms of things like catering. So people who were coming to May Day would have been asked to bring their own rations in. I've seen sort of letters referring to, please bring your own butter, because of rationing. But the enthusiasm for it didn't dwindle at all.
Do you think that the May Day, although some hesitation to it, it brings the sense of community to the college?
On the day. And that's now. Years ago, yes, it was part and an important part of the college. I don't think it's an important part of the college now. I think it's an oddity that we still have for as long as it lasts, which is great, but I don't think it's a cohesive bond.
No, I think, there was just it was just teacher training college. They were just 200 or 300, and they were close knit. Everybody knew everybody, and now we just don't have that at all. So, and the students mostly aren't here in May. They finish their exams. It's on a Saturday. They're not around on the Saturday. So, the student involvement now is quite limited, really.
So it seems. So then the people. So the alumni essentially that come back. Do you think they obviously enjoy it, or they have a sense of pride in that they were May Monarch?
Well, there's a huge sense of pride about being a May Monarch, which I always find quite ironic, really. They're a nice bunch of people. They really are, don't get me wrong. They're a lovely bunch of people. But, yeah, but the thing is with an alumni day, no matter what you hang it off, you tend to have a lot of fun, because you're meeting up with people you went to college with. So, for example, I run alumni days, or have run alumni days, in the other colleges. And the sense of celebration is as palpable. I just think probably May Day costs a lot more. And there's something definitive to hang it off of. But yeah, alumni days are very good fun. And that continues today, with the alumni coming back for May Day.
What's it like seeing the alumni in their costumes all together?
I mean, it's nice to see. It's strange.
Yeah, but strange.
They're such a nice, charismatic bunch of people. It's great. It's fascinating, really, to watch them, to listen to them. And it's also quite poignant, because you see them getting older and frailer and stopping coming. And I think some of the modern May Monarchs don't have the same kind of interest. They do it for 1 year as an experience, and then they're not going to come back in. So it's, yeah, there's a kind of dwindling number of people who do take it, do have huge pride in it, who come back year after year. I think we have somebody who's 67 years in a row, she's coming back. But whether that's going to continue, you know, is doubtful.
One of my proudest moments ever with May Monarchs is I ran for the 175th anniversary of Whitelands College. I ran a very large event in Westminster Abbey, and it was the Vice Chancellor who said, oh, shouldn't we get some of the alumni, all alumni invited, shouldn't we get them to process? And I went, light bulb moment, can we get the May Monarchs to process? And then at that point, the Vice Chancellor said, fantastic, but not in their costumes. I went, no, I absolutely agree with you, we're not pushing them. It would have been a little bit like a pantomime if they walked down the aisle. But they, about 20 of them came, and led by, you're going to have to remind me of his name, fabulous guy.
Kojo.
No, not Kojo. The
Q.
Q, yeah. Who was, yeah. He's Jordan. Middle Eastern. Jordanian. Jordanian.
Yeah.
He led them holding the, what's it called?
Procession of the Losking Cross.
No, it wasn't the procession cross, it was the mace. He was holding the university mace, and he is truly a beautiful Jordanian, fabulous guy in every sense of the word. And he was in this beautiful suit, and then after that, the oldest May Monarch who was back, and all the way down to the youngest May Monarch, all in their day dress, posh day dresses. And I found it spine-chilling. I just thought it was such a great representation of the college, because these are some of the best students we've had by definition, and here they are all at Westminster Abbey representing the college, which was great.
So just jumping back, you said about if they were all in their robes, how do they choose what to wear? Do they personally choose what to wear?
Up until the 50s it was made for them.
Yeah, the early ones, it was made for anybody, so that's why they're particularly loose flowing, so they fit anybody. And at some point, they started to take measurements, and although the May Monarch would still be revealed on the May morning,
they took
it would be known in advance, so that a dress could be made specifically for that person. It's surely only in the 1980s when they got to start choosing their
Absolutely,
own.
I think almost when King David, in fact. When you say choose their own, I can remember for the years I ran it, I used to march them up to the shops, or, well, actually shop bought ones were much later, right? But we used to have a tailor who, well, at one was an ex, a former student who used to make them. But we very much did restrict their choice. However, the first year, which was 2015, I didn't get involved. The robe was a shop bought, but entirely unsuitable at every level. Mm. And even her, bless her, the May Queen, she realised it was, but no one had guided her, no one had mentored her. So it had been her, it was like a party dress, like a nightclub dress. But she had that suitably mended, didn't she?
Yes, but she did for the previous year because it was so low cut. So low cut. I mean, it was, nobody knew where to look. So, yeah.
Including the
bishop.
The bishop. It was a bishop that year, wasn't it? Yeah. So. Yeah, including the bishop who was, installing her. So, yes, now they're always off the peg. There is not the funds to have them handmade. But I do hope some mentoring goes on. I think it does it. Do you get a say?
I don't get a say, no. I don't even know who the main monarch is until
the day.
Pretty much. I mean, a little bit before anyone's. Yeah. But no, it's that's completely on kind of college's hands. So,
so the designs of the dresses when they were made, would, is there like sort of a theme or?
No, it was there. Their ideas managed. That's how I'd call it. Their ideas managed. And in fact, Abby, who I mentioned earlier on, Abigail, who had this absolutely amazing purple outfit, well, lilac outfit of lace, well, no, chiffon. It was totally, that is chiffon material, is it? This, yeah. And this is one where one of the older alumni said, oh, it's entirely unsuitable. It was exquisite, but Abigail was about a size 6. And my only great fear about it was it would only ever fit her for 1 year. However, she's now, what, in her late 30s?
And it still fits her perfectly.
Yeah, yes. She's just as slim.
Very slim.
Yeah, having had 2 children.
Can you maybe describe maybe a couple of other examples of a main monarch's choice of robe?
I find it quite interesting that a lot of the non-British monarchs tend to revert to their traditional. I think that's lovely. Kojo was the first Nigerian. She was the second Nigerian because Hyacinth was Nigerian originally, but first male Nigerian, and he wore full tribal king. It was a Nigerian king's outfit. It was absolutely beautiful.
We recently had a Pakistani bridal outfit, which is also incredible. It's so heavy, she can hardly hold herself up in it, but also looks absolutely spectacular.
Yeah. Can you describe it? Was it embroidered?
A sequined.
Yeah.
Beads.
Beady,
yeah.
Was it?
Yeah. Thousands. So.
And then in the archive, what was the date that you had garments from and then to?
Well, the Kate Greenaway is the oldest.
Yeah. So 1887 till 2022, I hope.
Do I have 2023 yet?
No.
Oh, hasn't been returned.
No.
Oh, whoops. Never mind.
And you mentioned before that it was the archive, the garments in the archive are sort of like this way of also seeing fashion, I use loosely, through the ages. Can you describe that a bit more?
Well, if you go to the 60s bunch, it's Laura Ashley. Was that 70s?
70s.
Yeah. All Laura Ashley fabric, which I always love. 50s, sort of the crinoline, squeaky material, I always call it. Yeah. When polyester had first been invented. I say the Edwardians, it's astonishing silks and some hand painted, which really is quite breathtaking. And now, you know, whatever is. But as I say, what is fun now is that we do have a whole diversity of fashions, i.e. we have the international element coming in, which is good.
Also, the Second World War, we've got the austerity ones because of lack of material, so they've created different muslins or parachute material.
Oh, parachute, wasn't it? Yes.
Net curtains. Yeah.
Mend and make do.
Indeed. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else. Is there anything else you want to add in terms of their robes or...
I'd just say the robes that were often designed, were designed in-house, they were made like a whole... somebody would make a whole generation of them. You had like a Miss Sharp or a Miss Smith or a Miss Merton, and they would make dozens and dozens of dresses. Year yeah. after year, they'd be responsible for a massive labour of love and time.
And then when I was looking after it, it was the same tailor that we went to year after year. She loved doing it. She really got a big kick out of doing it until we could no longer afford her. But when we had the budget, it was great.
That's really interesting. I think in terms of the archive, I'm just going to ask, what is your favourite object or garment in the archive?
Mayday object.
Yes.
I'm going to say the album of photos, the old photos, because they're just so beautiful. They're so clear. You can really see people's faces and expressions. Yeah, even though they're not smiling, and year after year you get that going. So yeah.
I think mine, where it is damaged, badly sun damaged, is an original picture by Kate Greenaway of sort of traditional May Day, and it's just I find it exquisite. And right at the other end of the scale, there is a 1902 huge painting about by Anna Richards Brewster, who is an American artist, who was actually in the UK being taught by George Frederick Watts, and she came to May Day in 1902 and then presented this extraordinary image of May Day in early Edwardian times to the college. So those two pictures, because one of them is exactly in capturing what Ruskin wanted, and despite the fact that Anna Richards Brewster was being taught by George Frederick Watts, she has caught what May Day was like for the college. So I suppose I think from art history point of view, I think that's quite interesting.
And for the purpose of the project, so the Kate Greenaway dress is in the exhibition, can you describe the dress itself? If there are any like details that you know of that have specific influences, even if you sort of repeat maybe a little bit of what you've said about it being made, just so that there's like this sound bite that we could...
Well, it's made of cashmere. And the Royal School of Needlework so embroidered it. So no money was held back on it. But I think the description of that Ruskin made of it being like Madge Wildfire's costume is correct. She didn't quite get the brief right.
It's very drab. When I first saw it, I was expecting something amazing. So, oh, okay, this is it? So, yeah.
It has exquisite embroidery around the neck and on the bottom. And is the... No, the belt's not embroidered. Mm. The belt, I don't think, is even the original belt. But it was found, funny enough. Everyone heralded it as something that the archive had kept for over 100 years, and evidently it was found in the 50s in a cupboard, or 60s even, in a cupboard. So, no, it was just there by accident, which is so often the way.
Mm. It looks a bit like kind of religious vestments. It's kind of classic-y. And I did read, I don't know if this is true because I can't, I see what the provenance is, that it has daisies on and they're depicting Ruskin's pansies. Pansies, and there's the idea of like, a woman with his thoughts on him was, you know, pure and he'd heart ease and this type of business. the flowers being evocative of symbolic in Victorian literature.
Well, it's the language of flowers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so... And the other thing, I think both Gemma and I have had to sort of, not defend, but like be careful with, is the reputation that Ruskin's got. You know, particularly recently with films and everything that are coming out, you do have to be just ever so slightly cautious what you're up to. You know, which is why I think many monarchs need mentoring sometimes. So.
Did you want to go into that more?
No, because I think we've moved away from... I think we're far enough away from Ruskin that, you know... I always do... Well, I don't know if you do still, but I used to make or ask the main monarchs to read about Ruskin so that they are aware of his... Not dubious. Yeah, you could interpret him either way. He was a genius. There's absolutely... He's polymath. Absolutely no doubt about it. But he also had his issues, his demons. Which, yeah, can be problematic.
Okay. I think I'll ask the final question, if that's okay. So it's essentially, it's just because this recording is going in the archive with your names on it, is there anything that you wanted to expand upon or add to the recording?
I mean, I think it is kind of a privilege to have custodianship over this collection, and there's things like shoes, and it's quite personal. It's quite intimate. There's stockings. You can see sweat stains in your armpits of petticoats and things. So I don't know. You can just, there's a lot of history there that's just hidden. And sometimes I think it's just me that sees it, and as it's seeing the queens, the photos of them in the past when they were brand new, they had their whole lives in front of them, but we can see what happened to them. We can see their college record. We've got lots of literature. We've got, and if they come back, we've got the photos year after year as they get older, and we can see that. And I it brings home to me sort of time and the poignancy of time passing. And so yeah, I think it's quite a privilege to be involved with it.
Yeah, I think we're extraordinarily lucky to have the archive. Yeah. I don't think it's going to go on forever, but I think the archive will survive because it is of national importance, as stated by the V&A alone. Yeah, they recognise that.
So just to finalise, the future of May Day, you think that maybe it will come to an end in the near future?
Yeah, they have to justify the expense. So it's either, and this year they tried to downsize it and then people aren't coming. So now we've got to make it even bigger to attract people to come. So there's a real a quandary, I think, about.
And also the structure of the student population. We do not have 300 living undergraduate students here anymore. We have a lot of postgraduates who are never involved at all. They sometimes come along, but they're never a lot of postgraduates. Also, students aren't campus-based anymore. They, you know, if they are even living in, they tend to be going out to work as well. So it is not the same. So to keep patching it up, my honest belief is that it's got to stop being patched and it's got to be allowed to become a historic record, of which it's a very great historic record, of which hundreds of thousands of students have enjoyed over its history. But you don't want it to just fizzle out. My belief. You can continue with an alumni day and you can call it May Day, but without all the dressing up, bishops coming, etc., etc., etc. But it could still be an alumni day, which, you know, there's no reason for alumni days to cease. at the moment.
Yeah. I was going to ask a question, but I don't know how relevant it is to the Whitelands just out. You know the May Day poll? And it's actually used in like primary schools. Do you know why it was incorporated into? Can you talk
because
about that?
It's very easy. It's because Whitelands was a teacher training college. It taught hundreds and hundreds of trainee teachers to maypole dance, and of course they introduced it to their school. When I was a little one, there was a teacher who lived on our street who held May Day celebrations. Which I loved. I absolutely loved. My sister was once May Queen. I never was. Not that I bear a grudge. But she was a Whitelander. And that's how it happened. Whitelands spread area, which is what Ruskin wanted to happen.
So do you think even though, you know, sadly May Day may not continue at Whitelands as it does, do you think that it could elsewhere, sort of in a similar way? Or...
Well, folk dancing still carries on. You know, we didn't invent maypole dancing, we just reinvented it. I think if in schools they want to encourage children to dance and skip, and you know, maypoles are quite a fun way of doing it. I don't think the demise of May Day at Whitelands is the demise of maypole dancing. I have to be careful not to call it pole dancing.
But could it be the demise of May Day Monarch?
Yeah, you wouldn't have any more May Monarchs.
But as in, could another college pick that up, or do you know if other colleges do it?
I don't think so. I'm not aware of any of the places that used to do it doing it anymore either. Mm. I think that's kind of died out. We might be the only place. I don't know, maybe not so many.
Can I just add for you to talk about the books presented and the cross?
Well, the books are all volumes of Ruskin, have been from the word go, of which a lot of them have been returned to the archive, all of which are unread.
Yeah, a lot of them behind in that cabinet.
All unread, because even our lovely girls didn't want to read Ruskin. Seriously. And to this day, the Guild of St George, I still think they do present the books. Mm. The Guild of St George, which is the...
Oh, a couple or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still they get unread.
And the cross was presented to the May Queen and then Monarch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big bone of contention because that does cost money. And so I actually introduced the fact that it was the college loaning it and it had to come back. Up until a sort of certain time, it was understood that the college would give the cross, but on the passing of the monarch, i.e. when they died, it would come back to the college. And a lot of them have done.
Mm.
I then made it that the college owns the cross because we couldn't be seen to be spending £2,000-£3,000 on a cross.
Yeah,
exactly. And then not having it as a capital asset of the college. So we had to have it against our books. That was the only way we could get around that. And we then, a couple of times, we tried to just introduce one cross and it gets handed from monarch to monarch to monarch. But it keeps being...
The May Monarchs this year they came and said what they would like to do is reuse some of the old crosses. So if someone's got the same name as someone in the past, really have to like a design, that's going to be their cross that they're going to
But they keep it with the college.
Yeah. Which is quite a nice idea.
It's a very good idea. Yeah. It's just that the one good thing about the crosses now we've got them in house, sort of in a very large safe, is that we can put them on our books as a capital asset, which is always good for accountants to have capital assets to set the debt against.
And what was the symbol of the cross in terms of it being presented?
Well, see, this is a thorny issue. You know, is it Ruskin had a huge pectoral cross, like a bishop's pectoral cross, you know, a very large cross that goes here, hangs here. He gave that to the college. We have that in the safe. The May crosses were meant to be much more beautiful. In fact, the Victorian ones are exquisite. They were actually designed by Arthur Seven, who was Ruskin's cousin-in-law. And one of them was designed by Burne Jones, and that's actually in the British Museum, because it's a very fine example of, well, Burne Jones made very little jewellery, and he caused him great anxiety to create this, because he wanted to live up to Ruskin's expectations. I haven't ever seen any comment by Ruskin about the cross. He used to like Arthur Seven's crosses, because they are really pretty. Then Canon Rawnsley took up the mantle when Ruskin died, because Ruskin used to pay for them. When Canon Rawnsley, he of National Trust, etc., good new book, just out, we're in there. He made very, very ugly. He commissioned Wisley Arts and Crafts, because, which again is very Ruskinian, but much, much simpler arts and crafts, none of the beautiful daisies and embellishment. And then again, you know, with everything else, so for example, the wartime crosses, not the First World War, but the Second World War, were like tiny. Because of course there was not the money, it was not the, you could not justify spending money. And then when David Peacock, well, even before David Peacock, you know, they started to get bigger and bigger. And then a man called Andrew Tyler, who's a jewellery designer, he took up, his mother was a Whitelander. His mother introduced Andrew to the Whitelands College, to May Day, and he then used to create the most exquisite crosses, co-designed by the May Queen, or May King, and he used to do it at cost.
Lammas.
Sorry?
Andrew Lammas.
And Lammas. Of course, though, Liz is the title, wasn't she? Yeah, his wife. Yeah, so Andrew Lammas. And they are, it's such a superb collection of his work. But as I said, he used to do that at cost. There is a very famous jewellery man called Geoffrey Munn. He's often on Antiques Roadshow, if you ever watch that. But he actually found and purchased a May Day cross. And from there on, he got very passionate at May Day. And he's always there to help in terms of valuation or, you know, finding anything out about the crosses. So it's quite nice to have an expert on call.
Just as we're on this topic, were there any other, I want to call, say accessories, but any other sort of, I think there used to be staffs.
Yeah, sometimes we'd sort of decorated, weren't they? But it wasn't really if it was a thing at all, it didn't last.
Okay.
And again, with the crowns, flowers, they used to wear a crown of fresh flowers. That sort of pretty much died out, although some May Queens sometimes wear fresh flowers. Mm-hmm. And then the idea was you made a silk flower crown. But I can remember many nights, day before May Day, with queens in the archive trying to make themselves a crown. Shocking. Of course, this is a beautiful representation of a floral crown.
And is this, so it's a circular pole with flowers circling, like sort of winding around it. Would this be used in?
It was used this year, yeah, it was. But I don't think there's any particular symbolism for these flowers or anything. It was just.
No, but it looks very much like a good representation.
Yeah.
And now nobody wears a crown.
I can't remember the last May Queen or King.
I think the older ones have their circlets they put on, and they can choose to, isn't it?
So yeah.
If they want
to. Yeah, the ones coming back. There's a box full of old circlets. Yeah. Or in fact, some of them who made nice circlets do take theirs home because they don't want any other May Queens.
Hung up with their robes.
Yeah, because they don't want any other May nicking their circlet because they've made them. they've almost put more blood, sweat and tears into those than anything else.
And on the day then, so this sort of like circular...
That's called a flower bower.
A flower?
Bower.
Bower.
Yeah.
Is this something that pops up every year, or is there variations?
There used to be a much more elaborate one, which again I introduced, because I'm harking back to old traditions of them sitting under flower boughs. And so I bought a large one, and for a few years we had fresh flowers. It was absolutely exquisite, but got lost. Nobody knows where the flower bough went.
It's quite recently lost.
Yeah.
So it must just be in a storeroom somewhere. But So we had this year, and we had the two thrones that the retiring monarch and the incoming monarch sit on.
The thrones are they sort of from far back?
Yeah, both of them are from the sort of late Victorian, early Edwardian times, aren't they? I think it's medieval oak somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah, because actually one of them is a real throne, i.e. a commode. one of the ancient commode, yeah.
From the college originally?
No, I think May Queens bought it in 1904 or something, as one of the thrones. The other one is a traditional chair, never been dated, but by the look of both of them, they are old, maybe Jacobean.
But you don't have a sort of like knowledge of why they were chosen to be the thrones?
Well, they look like thrones. Particularly one of them, as it is.
Is there anything, like, I want to say the word rules, but are there any sort of rules that every year something has to happen or something has to be used or...?
There's a great saying in Whitelands, which I learned very early on, is if you do something one year, it's a tradition by the following year. And that is true, you know. If you introduce something, that's it, you're stuck with it.
So it's essentially, could you say, each year is a layering of the years that have passed?
Yes, with some things dropping out at the bottom. That's a very good description. But it's a little bit of a stress where people think, no, that's been going for years. No, it hasn't. Happened 4 years ago and now it's a tradition.
Is there anything else you think?
No. I would recommend that you read David Peacock's dissertation, because every single question you've asked is in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because he took 4 years to write that. He also ran May Day for about 12 years. So he and his wife.
What's the title of his PhD?
It is something like this, Whitelands College and May Day, isn't it, or something? Or John Ruskin and May Day at Whitelands or something like that.
Yeah.
Is it published?
Well, you can get it on the PhD's website.
Right, okay.
I think I've got it digitally as well.
Yeah, I have.
So if you want to, we have it. It's a romping good read.
I think just to end it then, have you enjoyed being a part of the May Day at Whitelands?
For me, absolutely yes. But I also really enjoy not being part of it now. Because everybody says to me every year, are you going? I go, no. Not for me. Yeah, I did it for 14 years. That is probably about 12 years too many. No, it is too many. I think it's actually David Peacock himself said 9 years is enough.
But the May monarchs love Julie, the ones that, you know, she dealt with, really, really talk about all the time. So I think they really, you know,
call
appreciated
me
her. Yeah.
They all call me mum.
Yeah.
I'm their May Day mummy. That's what they call me. Which is very touching and sweet and wonderful. However, it's a punishing thing to organise, to do it properly, to get it right. So
when you say to get it right, is it on the basis of what it was, or Like, what's it sort of based upon?
Getting it right is to make sure that everybody that's there enjoys it. If you've ever been to a very well organised wedding, you won't know it's very well organised. You've just all had the most wonderful time. That's the closest analogy I can find to it. Yeah, because the food has to be right, the atmosphere has to be right, the participants have to be right, the decor has to be right, the service has to be right, and everything has to be available. And that it is very, very similar to organising a wedding, i.e. it's exhausting.